From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia in seconds. Travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk or take the guesswork out of converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 60 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff. I'm here with Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer. We are the three co-hosts of the show. How are you guys doing?
I'm good. How are you guys?
I'm quite well.
Can't complain.
Evan, who's on the old program this week?
Today, it is a return appearance by one of my favorite guests on the show, Taffy Brodesser Ackner. She came on the show in 2015 when she was a freelancer with like 9 bylines at the same time. That was a big topic of our conversation. She came back in 2019 when she was a very established profiler working for the New York Times Magazine.
Was that the live show?
That was the 2019 was right after the live show. We did a live show with her, but we didn't put that out.
We had some chicken with her before that live show. That was the last time I saw her. It was right before that was right before COVID, right? That
2019, yeah.
For people at home, there's still a bunch of boxes of t-shirts from that live show that are like directly behind me. So maybe, just maybe, we may put the t-shirts on sale again so that I can clear some space in my home recording studio here.
So in that show, in the 2019 show, she was a established feature writer for the New York Times Magazine and GQ, but she had also just written a novel called Fleischman is in Trouble that was a New York Times bestseller. And now that novel has become a TV series for Hulu, for which she is the showrunner, the head writer.
Wow.
Yeah, she did the whole thing. It's out next week, I think. And so I drug her back into the studio to answer all of my questions about how this came about, her role in it, how she feels about it all. And as always, she was very open and very funny and very fun about talking about her journey through all this stuff. So it's great to have her back.
Man, write a novel, get it turned into a TV show, and then be the showrunner on the TV show. That's like hidden for the Triple Crown right there.
Yeah.
This show is brought to you in partnership with Vox Media, who help us make it. Thanks to all the good people over there at Vox.
And now here's Evan with Taffy Brodesser Ackner.
Taffy, welcome back to the show.
It's so good to be here.
This is the third time we've sat down for a formal interview.
I know.
And I feel like the progression is interesting. Like the first time I came in with, you've got so many stories, you've got 9 stories going at the same time. How do you do this? How's this working? The second time I came in with like, you've written this book and it's getting a lot of attention. Like, what does that feel like now you're on the other side? This time, the bus stop next to my house has a giant Fleischman is in Trouble advertisement for the TV show that you wrote. I feel like you've moved directionally from something I knew a lot about to something I only know a little bit about.
Same.
So
same.
First, describe sort of where you are now. It's about to come out. What state are you in right now?
I'm a wreck. I'm always a wreck before something comes out. And for the first time, I'm a different kind of wreck because I carry with me the names of all of these people who have good reputations. And I'm worried that the world won't like it, but I'm even more worried that they won't watch it. Like I turn on television now and I try to watch something and I haven't heard of any of it. And I'm a culture journalist. Like, if anyone's going to hear of it, but like there's a season of something, the fifth season of something, and I've never even heard it exists. And you see all of these tiles and you think, what if what I did just becomes that tile? It's like, you know what? It's a little bit like how I feel about my Billy Bob Thornton story, which was published
we talked
on
about
November 10th. And it is still a wound that I feel like I did something new in that profile that I was so proud of. And I still feel like it was not read fairly because it was born 2 days into what was supposed to be a Hillary Clinton victory, but was not. And like, what if I did this for 3 years? What if I sacrificed time with my family, time with my friends, and they don't watch it? Like, I don't even, if people hate it, that's fine. Like, I work at the New York Times and I am accustomed. Like, you can't find a story of mine where the first 10 comments aren't like, is this what you use your money for? Like, to send me to do whatever I did? Like, something so degrading, not about the quality of the story, but that it shouldn't even exist. Shouldn't even exist. And this, I don't know.
It's interesting to hear it in terms of, like, of course, when you say it, it's true that there are these tiles of TV shows and you haven't heard of half of them. And someone will be like, oh, my God, you haven't seen this and you've never heard of it. And you're kind of like, oh, what is that? I don't know about that, because there's so much TV being created.
Right.
But it's also, I was thinking of it that it's sort of operating on a different level in terms of attention. Like, the people who might hate it, they might be professional critics who actually are like, taking it apart. The first 10 commenters are the first 10 commenters.
Right.
So
right.
I was thinking, are you ready for like this level of attention step up from where you are? But it sounds like you're more like, I would like the attention to at least meet.
I would, because of the investment people made in this.
Yeah.
Whereas I am not looking forward to hearing that my colleagues did not enjoy my work. I am not looking forward to like even a hedged review. Like, I'm not, and I know those things will happen and they exist. But when I published the book, the fact that anybody was reading it was a shock to me. And what I know about television now is that the highest number of readers on any story that I ever published would be a failure for this.
Yeah.
But also that TV is easy to watch. And this failure would look like either nobody clicking on it or nobody pressing next episode. And that, like, I'm, you know, I don't know if they're going to tell me those metrics. I know at the Times, they try not to have writers know those metrics, but we're journalists and find them out. Like,
yeah.
You know,
I would assume in TV you can't get away from it. Like, people got those.
We'll, I think you'll know if something's a success or not. I wonder what success looks like to them. I wonder what success looks like to the network. Is it like watching something for 7 minutes? Is it reviews? Is it publicity? Is it people who stayed till the 8th episode? Is it people who hate watched it? Is it like, does it matter if they watch it at first or if they watch it in a year? Because you could binge it. It's not like a magazine story that loses its relevance.
All right. Well, we've jumped straight into the anxiety part of it, but let's go back a little bit, because
okay.
I think a fun part of this is like that it got done at all.
Oh, my God.
Because, you know, and I know many people, including myself, who have like had their thing go to be made into something and then it doesn't get made. So much less that they are an active part in creating it.
Right.
So I want to go back to, was almost when we spoke last, the book had come out. Walk people through the process a little. People may not know, like, how does this happen? How does it happen that first someone, like, takes control of it? And how? What was your role in that?
So I have these great rights agents. I was at ICM, which has now been eaten by CAA. And so now they are at CAA. And there were two people who were interested in the book. And I loved both of them. And I thought, how am I going to decide about this? But I wasn't going to do anything with it. I have a lot of experience in optioning magazine stories. And the way I don't even look at it as something that could ever get made. Mm-hmm. I think this is going to pay for 2 weeks of camp. Like, I look at it in modules, as I did stories when I was a freelancer. This is going to pay for 2 weeks of camp. It's my only passive income. But I remember talking to Jimmy Buffett for a story and him saying,
Jimmy Buffett does not live the Jimmy Buffett life.
Yes,
I remember that.
He does not endorse the Jimmy Buffett lifestyle. And I said to him, you know, I got to ask, I feel like I'm doing well at my job, but I feel like I'll never get ahead financially. And you're so rich. Like, how did that happen for you? And he answered me very sincerely. He said, well, do you keep just doing profiles like this? And I said, yeah, that's like my thing. I do profiles. And he said, it seems complicated. Like, the thing you need is for someone to make a movie out of a profile, but then they'd be making a movie out of my life. Wouldn't they come to me? And I thought, that's very wise, Jimmy Buffett. That's like Warren Buffett levels of wisdom.
He knows the business. Yeah. He knows all the angles.
And he said to me, you could think whatever you want of Margaritaville, but I knew very soon that it would be a child that supported me in my old age. Do you have any children that are supporting you in your old age? And I was like, no, I don't. And I had just written this novel and it was, you know, going to be published. And I thought maybe that's the thing, or maybe I should write other kinds of stories because I see all these people who have their movies. And it was just not happening for me. People optioned things, but then they bumped up against the Jimmy Buffett knowledge of you can't really... It's hard, the elements involved in everyone agreeing to make something, it's almost like magic. It's almost like religion. Like you can't believe, if I go back and look at every way this almost fell apart, a pandemic, like a literal pandemic, like in my version of Genesis, I'm about to make this and God decides to flood the earth. And I'm like, but I was just about to make this TV show. Like, oh my God, your pandemic? You're bringing in a pandemic now when I was just, but I was just about to. And it was, okay, so let's go back.
Yeah.
So I thought I wasn't going to be part of it.
You got two
people who
are
interested, and I'm interested in them. But my agents say, just wait till this comes out. This might not be, you know, I'm hearing about all of these books that are like, optioned for $1 billion in like while there were documents.
Yeah, yeah.
So I wait because as soon as I'm on the book tour and I'm kind of not I don't handle shifts in identity well. So I'm kind of freaking out about the book that seems to be on a trajectory to at least, like, there are people coming to my readings. And I just didn't think that that was supposed to happen. I was told to change the name of the book because it was too New York-y, which I don't know if you know what that's a euphemism for. But they're like, in Europe, they don't like New York-y things. And I'm like, I don't know. I think let's use our words here. And then there was this like, can you reduce your name down to Ackner? Because it's going to be hard for people to remember your name. And I was like, I can't do that. I can't, like, it did not seem like this was fated for success, right? And so the thing I did was I cut my book leave 2 weeks to go on tour. I cut it off because I wanted to do a story about the election. I was running out of time to do a story about the election. This is 2019, and I got to the Times, and of course, everyone had called dibs on all of the profiles, but I was like, joke's on you, because I want to do Marianne Williamson, which is not, you know, not only is it not a profile you call dibs on, it's something you have to beg your editors to let you do. So I did that because I felt like I have to get back into the game. Like, I had such a small idea of things. Like, if I don't go back to work soon. So I did this story. And while I was doing the story, the book went on the bestseller list. And then suddenly there was a lot of interest. And I was on this story. I didn't have time to meet with everyone who was interested. And so I asked my agents, please, you decide who I should meet with. And I took a call from Sarah Timberman and Susanna Grant, because when I was young and trying to be a screenwriter, Susanna Grant had written Erin Brockovich. And it, to me, was like this amazing thing for a woman to have written this muscular, excellent Steven Soderbergh movie. Like, I couldn't believe it. And I was like, of course, just so I could talk to her. And Sarah, I knew by reputation. And I spoke to them. And they were the only people who's, I said, well, would you write it? Like, who would you hire to write it? And they said, no, you have to write it. It's like, it won't make sense for anyone else to write it. Mm. And that, of course, like, I was so flattered by that. But also I was like, yeah, why, if I am looking for a way for my children to support me in my old age, like, the children are named Residuals and they are based on, like, really it was a money decision because I really wanted to move out of New Jersey. And as I have been from the minute I moved there. And then also, when I talked to other people who were writers who wanted to do it, I was jealous of them that they would get to do it. And then I would hear some ideas of theirs, and they seemed to not really understand what I thought of the book, meaning they liked it for different reasons, which happens in every story. But now you're going to, like, will I be someone who couldn't watch that? And then a friend of mine who had had something made, I asked her what she thought of it. She was a passive executive producer or a producer or consultant on it. And she said, it's fine. Like, it's like you have to look at it the way you look at a magazine story. She was also a magazine writer. Look at a magazine story, which is once you sell it, it's not yours. Mm-hmm. You may have like 4 credits cards on it, but it's not yours. And my heart was kind of broken because I had this understanding that Fleischman being my first fiction thing would be the thing that was closest to me. And these two women, I had rarely worked with women in my life. They just taught me how to do it. And there were no power issues. And they also taught me how to sort of do this while being a mother, while being a wife, while being a friend, while being someone who should probably do cardio twice a month or something. Like, I learned a lot from them. And I also got to write it. So I said yes to them. And I had 2 more stories to do. Actually, I had 1 more story to do, was Tom Hanks.
Mm. Was it the Val Kilmer after that?
And then the Val Kilmer after that. But the Val Kilmer I had been pursuing for 5 years. So I was about to leave, and it was like a Lethal Weapon movie. Like, suddenly I got, you know, Val Kilmer will finally talk to you. And I was like, but I was just, okay, 1 last story. And we went for it. And I was in Los Angeles interviewing Val Kilmer when I got an email from the Times saying that non-essential people had to come home. And I was like, oh, I'm on a Val Kilmer story, so what should I do? And they were like, can you finish your report? They were very polite about it. Can you finish your reporting on
what do you mean
phone?
By non-essential?
I know.
You know, I'm talking, like, Val Kilmer
here. I don't
here.
Think you understand what I've landed on here. And I went home, and I thought it would be dead, because what happened was, because there were bidders, I had a very good deal, and it was like a straight to series if they like the written pilot. Like, you don't have to make a pilot. Mm-hmm. And that kind of deal helps you get better actors, like actors who know that something is greenlit once they start it. It's like, and also you don't break your heart making something that never gets to see the light of day.
Yeah, like, they would make a full pilot in many cases and then just say, nah, we're
and then they'd
it.
Say, this is, yeah.
Just forget it.
And I always knew about this, that you have, like, the whole thing is an experiment in storytelling. You have to make the whole thing in order for anyone to really get it. The executives, like, for whatever you hear on television about, like, dumb executives, like, not one person in this equation had a bad idea. Not, like, they all wanted it to be what it was. They didn't want it to go more commercial. And they left it all up to me. They had suggestions, but, like, at the end, it was all up to me. And the show that's there is the show that I and my producing partners and the directors all wanted. Like, it's, you read the book and you saw the show. It's the same thing, right?
Yeah, it has so much fidelity to the book.
I mean, like, some people would say what like, you could do that in a bad way, but I think it just feels like it too. Like,
yeah,
it's a very, it feels like it to me. So The pandemic came, and suddenly, like, the blood cells go to the site of infection. I was not an infection. I was a deal that had just been signed. And they had a million shows that were in the middle of being shot, and what are they going to do? And so we created a mini room of writers who had experience in television, who spent 10 weeks telling me how they would cut this up, like this book, like what would you do here, and what and how do you, I'm such a word person, how do you translate this into the screen? Mm-hmm. Sarah and Susanna were sort of the chiefs of that, but we had great people. We had Cindy Shupak, Boo Killebrew, Michael Beck, and our own Allison P. Davis. Mm. She was in there. Everyone there had a ton more experience than I did in this.
In writing for television?
In television writing.
And so at this point, so did you, you had nothing then? You had not put down anything? You were just trying to like break apart the book and figure out where it would go?
I had written the pilot.
Uh-huh.
And then as we went, I wrote a document that's required that shows what each episode would be about. And then I wrote the episodes, and that was it. Like, I kept waiting for it to be, like, to have a rug pulled out.
Yeah.
I kept waiting for someone to have been the secret person who was in charge to come out and show themselves, because that's a story I hear a lot.
Yeah.
And the one thing I asked of my producers, I said, I would like to go with you. The thing I will ask is that if I can't do the show running, please tell me that and don't have a secret person who's really in charge, because I just don't want to be embarrassed. Like, I can take it if this is something that I'm beneath right now. Like, but I can't take the humiliation of finding out that someone else that was close to me was the showrunner. It's like a game. It's like, what's the kids, like Among Us. Like, it's like, and I keep seeing that same story. And Sarah Timmerman made this promise. And not only did she make this promise, she moved from L.A. to New York and was on set every single day so that I didn't have to have a secret showrunner. Like, you could say she was the secret showrunner, but she was there to help me guide in my positions. When I got there, there was not one person who didn't have more experience than I did. And everyone was so kind to me. They were so patient with me. There were words I didn't know. And I realized that every time I'd been on set as a journalist, it was like theater for me, yeah. Which we all kind of know, but like in a really, like real theater, like real, like, you know, people are moving so quickly. You know, I thought we'd be making TikTok dances in between setups. We did not, which is probably for the best.
Wise is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? Then Wise just might be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. You can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wise. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this ad. Whether you're traveling, spending money abroad, or doing business, let Wise help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, WISE.com. Wise.com.
I mean, I know that you had written screenplays before, so like...
I mean, I have a degree in film and television. Yeah. I did not know one of these things.
But I can imagine when you sat down for the writing, you were like, I can figure out how this goes. Like, it's writing. It has formats. It has structures. But then when you actually walked on the set, did you call one of these producers first and say, like, what do I do when I get there? Like, what do I do?
Nope. I walked on there and just was quieter than usual. We also had two executive producers who came on as directors, Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris. They did Little Miss Sunshine and Ruby Sparks, and we had this great DP, and then we had these other directors who came on.
Something's wrong here. Every time, everything is better. Like, every single thing is like, oh, and this amazing person worked.
It became a machine that went of itself.
It just, like, everything sounds like a dream in some way. Like, even from the outside, without even knowing your experience of it. Because it's like, you wrote, I mean, you have, like, obviously, like, the big name, like, Jesse Eisenberg, and you have Claire Danes. But then for a smaller role, Christian Slater plays what is, like, not a huge role in the show. It's not in every episode. It's in, like, two episodes, maybe. Christian Slater's playing this magazine writer.
Right.
And, which I think last time we talked about that character in the book.
Yes.
You profiled Christian Slater in 2016, maybe?
Yeah.
And in the profile, you talked about how you'd always imagined interviewing Christian Slater since you were like 10 or 12 years old.
Yes.
Now he's playing a role in the TV show.
It was a crazy thing.
But did you make these things happen? Were these things prompted by you? You were like, what about Christian Slater? Can someone send it to him? Or someone else just, kismet, was just like, how about Christian Slater?
No. We were, okay. It's a different question. The question is, how is TV different than journalism? In journalism, you write a note, you want to write this story. This person has a publicity obligation. They try to limit your time. My skill, as I see it, was always to get more time than was asked for, right? Do you remember, I remember that one, that my indecent proposal quote? Did I ever tell you that?
No,
that whenever a publicist is like, you can only have 45 minutes, I say, let me quote from my favorite movie, Indecent Proposal. Nothing will happen that he didn't want to happen. And that usually gets a laugh, and then they can't remember what they were saying. So that's how it works. But in journalism, it's all people don't like journalists. If we knew it before, I'm here to confirm it, that, like, the things that open up for you when they're this, like, journalism with a celebrity is a part of their job that they have to deal with.
Right.
The other stuff is the thing they want to deal with. They want to work. They want to be part of things that are big and have big names, and some of them know that them being in it makes it big. Like, everyone understands their capital, and their agents understand their capital, and you put together something. It was the hardest job I ever did. It was like election night every day. Also, being a boss was not easy for me. There is a line, I don't know if in the fifth episode, where he doesn't get his promotion, mm-hmm. and his kids are like, so did you get a bigger office? And he said, I turned down the promotion. I don't want to be a boss. Everyone hates you, and you don't get to do the thing you loved anymore. And I wrote that on a grim day. But it was mostly a very hard, really incredible experience of making something with your own hands, of like having a say in every aspect of it. I've never made something so completely. And I would say it's a more controlled environment, and that changed everything. That makes it not a thing where you're constantly using charm and negotiation and making promises to get more time. You have it. You have the time. You have the money.
Yeah. A lot of money.
It's a lot of money, but it's also very high risk. Like, when I would think about it in terms of a story, like, the highest risk story I ever did was that Bill May story where, you know, they had to send me to Russia for 2 weeks and probably took out some minimal amount of insurance on my life. Mm-hmm. And that was a very expensive plane ride. You know, like, what are the risks to sending me, like, on a story? If it doesn't work out, they can,
like,
kill
10
it.
10 seconds of your TV show.
I know.
Cost-wise.
And you can't believe it. Like, when they would talk about, the first time I looked at a budget, our line producer, I asked her for the budget. And I looked at it and I was like, oh, it's a million drillion. Like I don't have a place in my head for what these things cost, how much they should cost. And the overall amount of money that you spend on a television show. It is remarkable. And it's also a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
Like, to fail at something that's that much versus to fail, like, I can think of a couple of stories I've tried that didn't work out. Right when the book came out, I was in the middle of trying to do a Miss America story. Mm. And it never just came. They wouldn't answer me. It was, like, too hard. And then I went on leave. And I still think of doing that. So please nobody take that from me. But I did spend a weekend at the Hard Rock Cafe in Atlantic City. And I have so many words to describe the Hard Rock Cafe in Atlantic City. And also the Miss New Jersey pageant. That's the thing I went to the weekend before the book came out. And it's nothing like I'm staying at the Hard Rock for a weekend.
Yeah.
Nothing compared to like what the budget was for the coffee on the set for a week, right? Like, or, you know, there are food trucks, there are trailers. Also, you don't have to, the one question people have is you didn't know how to do anything. That's okay. You only have to, like, you're not, because of unions, you're not allowed to do anything.
Right.
Like, your costume designer knows everything. She was the greatest, and she could tell me, you know, we set it in 2016, and she could tell me what jeans looked like in 2016. And every now and again, for a big scene, she would say, you know, we would do a lot of planning at the beginning for a look for a character. And then for a very big scene, she'd show me options.
And you'd be like, this
and
one,
I'd
not
be like,
that one.
This one, like, not that one. Exactly.
Huh.
And that's what I became. The red truck, not the blue truck.
And the, I mean, I don't think of you as someone who would be starstruck being surrounded by all the people, but I am interested in the amount that you could, like, experience the sort of, like, holy shitness of this situation. Like, you filmed in the Natural History Museum in
Can
New
you
York
believe
City.
That?
You're, like, filming with Claire Danes. How much were you kind of like, oh, my God, I can't believe this is happening today versus the pressure? Like, this feels like it's creating enormous pressure. Like, could you enjoy it? Were you sitting there being like, I can't believe this is happening to me?
Here are the two shocking moments that happened to me vis-a-vis what you're asking. We weren't allowed to have rehearsals because of COVID. So we got everyone. I took the cast out to dinner outdoors in December a few times so they could get to know each other. I think Jesse and Claire had one rehearsal together. And luckily, Lizzie and Jesse knew each other. But nobody knew anyone enough to play their spouse or lifelong best friend, except maybe Jesse and Lizzie. And we sat down at this table at Odeon, and the way they began talking to each other, which was very intimate, was like a punch in the stomach, because I had always thought that I got people to open up to me.
Mm-hmm. And your,
like,
profiles.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, no, I got them to answer questions differently than maybe they had before. But this is a level of immediate intimacy that you have with people that you know you're going to work with for a year. And that was devastating. Hmm. Like, it was a little devastating to me. But then also I watched as they just within a second became this unit where everyone was talking fast and everyone. So, but I was too busy thinking of myself. And then the second time was I had a dream that I did a profile of Jesse. And the profile was the best profile I've ever written. And I woke up and I was sad I couldn't do it. Like, I was sad that that ship had sailed and I would never be able to do a profile of Jesse Eisenberg. Here's the awful part. I remember what it was, and it's a very good idea.
Oh,
I'm
really?
Not, I can't even give it to you because it's like, it's such a good idea. Okay, anyway.
You can't give it to the world.
I can't give it to the many writers here, none of whom would take it. Everyone else would hear it and be like, that's not that good. But in my mind.
In the dream.
In the,
yeah. Be,
you know?
I want to go back to Christian Slater for a second because
okay.
I
have
to
that
know.
Question. Okay, okay.
I just have to know, like, did you have a thing with him when he showed up where you were like, remember when I profiled you? And he was like, yeah, I really got you. Like, I didn't tell you anything in that profile. Like, did
no.
you talk about it?
No, not at all. Well, when we asked him to do it, it was, who should we do? This is like a sort of cameo plus. It's like a major character gets mentioned a lot, but it's like one day of work or 2 days of work. And all of it's in New York, and I knew he lived in New York. And he had read the book and written to me after he'd read it.
Hmm.
And I wrote to him and I said, I have this crazy idea. And he wanted to do it. And then I also asked Jake Tapper the same favor. And then they were on stage. And I did, I think they were, I wrote about them for GQ the same year. And I looked at that stage and I thought, I wonder if I'm allowed to be a journalist anymore after this. Like, I felt very weird about the fact that I had asked, but I felt a little better that I asked that it was a GQ thing and not a Times thing. Like, the Times has so many more rules, and GQ, like, at the very least, we ask people to attend a party in honor of the issue, which is kind of the same thing.
And they make them wear fancy suits and stuff. They take photos of them. Like, it's a little bit of a different
animal. It's a different
animal. But then you also have this scene which involves Christian Slater playing the magazine writer with a bunch of magazine people in a
bar.
Did
you see them?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. There are 12 people who will know what's going on there. And I'm glad you're
But you brought these magazine friends of yours into this scene.
I said, can you, Men's Magazine Writers of America, will you please come and populate this scene? And they did.
Well, that led me to think about something that we had talked about, just about the novel. We had talked about it more in terms of the divorce aspect of the novel and people, you running into people who are like, I know who that is. Yeah. I know who you wrote about.
Yeah.
I feel like the TV aspect of it could magnify that. When I was watching it, I thought, oh, a lot of like magazine writers will see themselves in that magazine writer. For better or worse, will either feel accused or celebrated, depending on how they view it. But do you feel like you're going to get more of that now that it's like embodied in some person and someone will look at that and be like, that Jesse Eisenberg, that's me?
Maybe. I don't know. Like, I do still hear that people are like, I know who that's about. And I say, oh, who? And they tell me. And sometimes I've never heard of those people. And sometimes I have. And sometimes people say to me, do you know my ex-wife? And I think that the thing I learned is that the Tolstoy thing is wrong. Like, all happy families are the same. All unhappy families. No, I think all unhappy families are exactly the same. Like, I think all divorces are exactly the same. They all, like, when people started reading this book or they heard I was writing it, they would tell me their story, and it was like a VH1 Behind the Music, like, you know the rhythms of it.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing was ever a shocking thing.
Hmm.
And I guess that's how I feel about people will see that Men's Magazine scene and they'll wonder who that is, or they'll be like, I know who that is, or like, is it an amalgam of a bunch of people? It's also a different story than the one I had, right? Like, I wasn't that writer at GQ. I wasn't frozen. I was not a staff writer, and I wasn't frozen out. I feel like I wrote the big stories there.
Yeah. So we're talking about the character in the book and now the TV show who is a magazine writer for Men's Magazine, but she never gets the big stories.
Right.
They send,
she
like,
leaves
these dudes out to do these, like, blood and guts, bourbon swilling stories.
Yeah, like men. Like, this is how to be a man.
But you didn't. You're not that person.
I don't feel like I was. If I was, no one has told me yet. Like, I had my own complaints at GQ, but none of them was that they wouldn't let me do the thing I asked to do. If there was any discrepancy, it's that I don't think it would occur to me to go to the top of a mountain and eat the still beating heart of a goat or whatever it is in the book. Like, I don't think that would occur to me. That is a specifically aged thing.
Yeah.
And I think I was more interested in other things, and some of them, Fleischman is in Trouble happened because I called up my GQ editor and said, I think I have a good story. And he was like, this is not a good story.
I remember that.
Yeah. And here we are.
Divorced men on dating apps.
And he's like, okay, it's time for you to not live in the suburbs anymore or retire.
You're only in the show for a second.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it. So you're not getting like necessarily like street recognized famous off of that extra scene at the end. But we talked at the beginning about your concerns about people not watching it. But the flip side is, like, if a lot of people watch it and it gets a lot of publicity, which I'm imagining will be the case, I understand why you have reservations about that, you may move into a different realm of recognizability, whether it's like name-wise, obviously, but even like your person. Are you ready for that element of it?
I don't know. That's an interesting thing that I try not to think about. But my children, you know, who watched this book come out, and in our small town in New Jersey, suddenly everyone knew who I was. And they began to think of me as famous because in this small town. But I don't know. So the only times I've ever been recognized are in highly Jewish places. My children say that I'm Jewish deli famous, that like if I go somewhere, I could reasonably expect a free knish.
Do you have feelings whether you're afraid or excited about the idea that you might just walk down the street and people will be like, Taffy, I loved your show?
You know what? I think that like I just went through a year of dinners with people. People don't do that.
They
people
don't
are
do that.
Weird about it.
Oh, when you were
you.
With these very famous people,
yeah.
That did not happen to them that often.
But people stared at them. People
yeah.
tried to interact with them. We had a waiter.
Like pretend not to.
Yeah, pretend actually, not to. Yeah. And that, yeah, it was like people are not straightforward about it.
Uh-huh.
But those people are very famous. Like those people are very meaningful in people's lives because they have enacted some emotion that meant something.
Right.
I don't know if it would be the same thing.
Right.
But I do know that the most hilarious thing was that when Jesse, Lizzie, Adam, and I had a dinner once, and someone came up to the table and said, are you Taffy? And we all laughed so hard. And she almost walked away, and I said, I'm so sorry. I don't mean to do that. I said, you see who I'm with. And she said, that's how I knew it was you. I thought it might have been you. And that was like the time I got recognized.
So, but what does it mean for you returning to reporting? First of all, are you going to return to reporting?
I'm scheduled to. I hope to. I have come to the conclusion now that I've written a novel and some episodes of television that a magazine story is like my best format in that the thing I do is an ironic or absurd play against the thing it's in, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like to write an emo Gwyneth Paltrow story in the New York Times font is not the same as just writing a Gwyneth. Like part of the theater of that story or of any story is that it's in the New York Times. And the New York Times is a place where you can expect serious, in-depth journalism and not someone who crying all the time or has to go to the bathroom or is afraid of someone, right? Like, I feel like that was the best version of my writing, and I would love to do it again. I don't know what, you know, I've started talking to my bosses about the rules, about what would I be able to...
Yeah, what would you be allowed to
do? I mean, right, like, with the consolidation of agencies... Like, could I write about someone who has the same agent as Jesse Eisenberg? And what I would say to that is, like, the thing I always felt very proud of was that I was not a friend of the court. Like, I did not pursue relationships with these people afterward. And I think that the profiles that I see that make me really cringe are the ones where the writer is working very hard to tell you, and this is like historically,
mm-hmm.
I haven't been reading a lot lately, but historically, like, look at me, I was with the person. Whereas you should really be like, it was crazy, I was with the person, as opposed to at some point I became one of them. And the people I know who do this well don't do that. And I feel like...
But you feel you could still maintain that.
I hope so. But I do wonder if, you know, someone's publicist will see me. I don't think it's fair for someone's publicist or agent to see it's me and then tell their client, don't worry, she'll be good to you because I'll be who I am to you. Like, my vanity as a writer is bigger than any sort of future relationship I ever want with a publicist or agent.
Mm. But they might say, oh, she's one of us.
Yeah. And that's, like, dangerous, right? That's, like, it's probably unethical. It's unfair. And it's dangerous because I think I already didn't have the affect of a regular journalist. Like, I'm goofy, I laugh, I cry, my name is Taffy. Like, all the things that you don't expect were already there. And to also say, don't worry, she's one of us. I mean, am I? I guess that's the question. Am I? I don't know. Do you think I am from where you're sitting? I'm having like a real identity crisis over it. I need to be real with all of you.
It's hard to tell. I mean, there's a couple things going on. There are rules. There's sort of like a disclosure element where it's sort of like, do you have to say like, I am a part of this industry, but there's a lot of...
Like, just like, so you know, I'm really a journalist. Think of how you say that.
Yeah.
I've thought this through. Like, what do I say to somebody? Like, just so you know, I'm at my job.
You could just do non-film and TV. People.
Right. Then I could do profiles of, you mean other people?
Yeah. There are other people
non-celebrities?
Out there.
Yeah. Am I also afraid to find out that the reason people were reading my work was because they were actually interested in the famous person? There's so much vanity in this. Like, even when your name is in, like, the 4-point New York Times font, the thing I kept coming across was that night where everyone was very open to each other. And I keep thinking about the ethics of the celebrity profile now. I always thought that I was ahead of the ethics because I wasn't mean. I never made jokes at people's expenses. At least I don't think I did.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there are various degrees of that. I was funny in stories, but I don't know if at their expense. And I know there are a couple of people who really hated their stories, and I don't understand why, because I did not ask. But I do have a question now about the ethics of taking somebody who, in success, hopes to pretend to be somebody else all day, and then making them sit across from me so I could tell the world what I saw when they were not being a character. Like, that isn't what they wanted to do. They wanted to do the other thing. They wanted to subvert their personality into something else. And now I'm just like, well, congratulations on doing that successfully, because now you have to sit with me for what you think is 45 minutes, but I will somehow turn into 6 hours.
Yeah, but then the lesson of the dinner you said was partly that then you realized, oh, I didn't get it. Like, I thought I got the real person.
Then what am I printing?
I just got another character.
Then what am I printing?
Well, then why wouldn't you say, you know what? I'll just write more TV shows.
I mean, I might say that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll
see.
Are
you going to say that?
I might say that. I don't know. Let's see how this goes. This is like very, this is very intense. Like, there are taxis with... this building.
Yeah.
There are people sending me text messages of those things. There's a billboard on Sunset Boulevard that I was told about while I was in LA for a sound mix a week ago. And I drove as if in a trance. And I remember when I lived in LA, the billboards, you would write a story about someone. And 2 weeks after it closed, the billboard for what they were doing would go up. And it had this relationship where I'd be like, we're saying hi to each other. And then my book turned into a show that has a billboard. I have the same feeling I had when I would look at those monitors. I can't believe this happened. It does not feel... Eventually, I felt like a magazine writer, not just a movie character who had wackily found myself doing magazine stories, and I don't feel like this is real yet. I feel more myself right here with you than I have in a long time. I'm going to cry again. Well. See, I told you. I told you. Oh, no. And by the way, speaking of this podcast, you know, Sam Anderson is a real trigger for me because I feel like he just writes the best stories.
He's
and
great.
He's just like a heartbreaker, and he finds the depth of something. I always feel like a good writer finds the depth that you knew was there but didn't acknowledge. He goes even further. And when he was on the podcast a few weeks ago and he was saying, I had to shut it off after he said the thing that I always believed, which is being a magazine writer is... Tom Juno says a version of this too, is the best way of being a human. Like, when I'm writing a magazine story, I feel that I am living in a way that no one else gets to. And when I was writing a television show, people would say, how do you feel? And I'd say, I feel like I died. I just wanted to be on the next story. And I was sitting there in the mausoleum of something I wrote in 2016. And you remember how much I published. You remember that the reason you brought me on, I think it was, I have not listened. I wanted to listen to the podcast, but I thought it would be too heartbreaking. But I remember it was like suddenly, or maybe in the introduction, it was like, I came out of nowhere and suddenly I was everywhere. Something to the effect of that.
Yeah.
And now what? I must have died.
Well, now you're on billboards.
Those are actors. But it's like still with the same title of the same thing. You know, after the Gwyneth Paltrow story published and a million times since then, I get calls from if she does anything to be the talking head. Hmm. And I always very strictly said no to those things. I'll do what the Times wants me to do for publicity within that week. But you can't get too caught up in the thing or else it gets into your head and you feel that you're defined by it.
Yeah.
And now that ship has sailed.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if I could write. I don't know if my second book will be any good. I don't know.
I will say every time you've said you've had something coming and said, like, I don't know. I know that feeling, but it has turned out to work out in each case.
Maybe.
So your second book.
I don't know. But there has to be a point where you're like.
Does there?
I don't know.
There doesn't have to be. There can be. You don't have to follow the VH1 Behind the Music arc.
Evan, that's such a nice thing to say.
You could just keep progressing along.
That's why I love coming here.
Thanks for coming on the show again.
Oh, Evan, it's so good to see you. Thank you for having me.
That's it for this week's show. Thanks for Taffy for coming on the show for a third time. Her television show, Fleischman is in Trouble, is on Hulu, should be out in a week or two from this air date. Thanks to Seth Kelly, who edited the show this week. Thanks to Susan Peterson, who did the show notes. Thanks to my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer. I'm Evan Ratliff. Thank you for listening. We will see you next week.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.